The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
You know, they promise you everything, and now you just don't have the money to do it. And so it's going to be interesting to see, you know, again, what Trump does here, how this thing plays out. But I think all the indicators are there. You better start getting some assets that are out of control of the government and the banking system. Now, I'm not telling you put it all in there. I'm not telling you leverage up to do it. But from a survival standpoint and an insurance standpoint, you got to start thinking ahead.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Bill King is our guest. I always look forward to Bill King. I mean, he just speaks his mind. His mind actually travels at about 3 times the speed of light, so I have a hard time sometimes keeping up. But he's an amazing analyst, Dave, and his thoughts have been formed out of, what, 4 decades of trading.
Right. Don't be surprised if you, like me, have to listen to the program twice. But that's because he's bobbing and weaving between strategic insights on a macro level and tactical decisions which can and need to be made, things that are happening in the market on a minute-by-minute basis. And he's got enough history behind him, as you say, decades and decades, to see how these things coalesce and the important lessons of the past and how they do apply in the present.
I know his report is the one report that I would definitely not miss each day. We get a lot of research. Bill's is the one that I always look at.
Well, Bill, we always enjoy having you on the program. You know, since November, the markets have been keenly in tune with politics and with policy shifts. And I'm curious how you would characterize the current leadership in the White House. You've got Bannon that's gone, Schiller that's gone, the West Wing is predominantly Democrats. Can you give us some perspective?
Well, that's the question everybody's wrestling with here is, you know, what is going on? What does Trump stand for? And who's controlling him? And yet another curve thrown when Trump really took a shot at Paul Ryan and McConnell by siding with Schumer and Pelosi over the 3-month debt limit hike for the, you know, Hurricane Irma, when the Republicans were looking for a year to 18 months. And of course, the conservatives were livid, and even got more complicated when Trump tweeted out the DACA dreamers, "Don't worry, you know, I'll take care of you," essentially. And then Fox broke the story that Pelosi asked him to tweet that out. So that the big concern has been that the Goldman Sachs guys and the Democrats in the White House have control of Trump's domestic agenda. And that's a concern here. And now it's kind of getting worse. There's a couple things where you have to look. Now, the stock market has gone up, but it's not like it was earlier. And the stock market is a different dynamic. And let's put that on the side for a while. But the big dynamic I keep looking at is the dollar. And the dollar just keeps going lower and lower. I think we're down to multi-year lows here. And you have to ask yourself, the stock market's going up because they think Trump's domestic agenda, tax cuts, all this stuff's going to be good for the economy. You know, straighten out the immigration, you get infrastructure, you amend Obamacare. It's not going to be a full repeal, but you amend it so it'll help businesses. You know, you get rid of rules and regulations. I got that. That should also help the dollar, especially when you got the Fed talking about normalizing more so than any other central bank. You know, the ECB had the chance today. They didn't do anything, and they punted the decision on the QE taper until next month. And, you know, if I was a betting man, I think there's good odds that they'll punt it in October to December again. And, of course, what happened is you got the euro going much stronger, the dollar down, gold up, a little bit under 1% right now. But you have to say, what is it with the dollar that is screaming here? Now, the dollar rallied initially very sharply when Trump got elected. A lot of that was short covering, a lot of it, you know, again, talking about a more conservative agenda, whatever. But when the dollar's going, you know, it's really tumbling here. And it should only go down really for 2 reasons. One is geopolitical, and we understand what's going on, you know, with that. That's a problem. But the other is your domestic agenda. And Trump, especially if you get the Fed, is going to try to start normalizing. They're going to, you know, they're talking about starting to trim their balance sheet. There's something that is spooking the dollar in a big way here. And you can talk about leadership, whatever, but, you know, you look at the previous administration, there was really nothing that went on. There was really no leadership in that, you know, as far as domestic or even foreign. In fact, most of the problems we have now is because of the previous 2 or 3 administrations let North Korea fester, you know, turn a blind eye to Iran, et cetera. So, okay, yeah, there's this problem with North Korea, and maybe that's weighing on the dollar a bit here. But you have to think that the bigger issue, because it's just persistent, has to be something in the Trump's domestic agenda. And I think the fear here is that Trump is a Democrat at heart. He likes debt. He wants low rates. you know, he's kind of wishy-washy on everything else. So I think that what the dollar's saying is that people are fearing that he's going to be much more liberal in his domestic agenda than people believe, which is you're probably going to get some kind of tax reform, and there'll be some tax cuts there for the average guys and probably tighter taxes for the upper crust. Now, their rates are going to go down, but he's probably going to get rid of loopholes, get rid of the carried interest for hedge funds and Wall Street. So net-net, they're probably going to pay a little more. Even the corporate tax rate, if it goes down to 22 to 25, which is what Ryan is saying, and you're saying, well, it's coming down from 35, but how many big corporations actually pay 35%? I mean, we sit here and we see IBM and these guys come up with 9%, 10%, 5% tax rate, or GE doesn't pay any taxes for, you know, umpteen quarters. So it depends on what you do in here. And at the same time, he wants infrastructure, he wants this whole debt thing. So I think there's a feeling here in the dollar that the guys in the White House with the agenda, that you're going to get bigger deficits going forward here. And that's what weighs on the dollar here. And I think you throw in the geopolitical turmoil, and I think that's why, you know, you're seeing gold is starting to really act well. And the best thing about the way gold is acting, you know, you get these where you get a surge, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 bucks, and then it would roll over. But what you're starting to get now in gold is that persistent grinding, 4, 5, 6 bucks, 9, and pops up 1%, retreats a little. And then the guys come in, they try to whack it down. But then it just kind of, what that is showing you, when you get the big surges, that's traders, that's hedge funds, that's, you know, lemmings. They see a chart, they see a breakout. But when you see the persistent buying, that's the big private money. And that's what the market is telling me here. With a long decline and going in the dollar and this persistent bid in gold, that's careful. You know, they're not running it like the wise guys do with stocks or whatever they're buying. They want immediate performance. Now, the big private money, it looks to me like they want to establish positions, and they're very careful how they're buying it. So I think it's one of those times now. I always think you should have some kind of insurance, gold or silver kind of insurance, but now I think you need more than that. I think there's something else going on in here. So even personally, I've been increasing, you know, my holdings of gold, paper, physical, whatever here. I think it's time to really increase your gold exposure because the market is telling you something here. And I don't think a lot of people are paying attention.
Right. So the $30, $40, $50 moves, you know, which you could say, okay, this is geopolitics. What you're saying is this move is more than just measuring the tensions that we have with North Korea. And if that gets resolved, it may continue higher regardless of the headlines relating to some of those geopolitical tensions.
Well, even if you solve North Korea, the problem goes right to Iran. So who are joined at the hip? I mean, if you want to really get in there and do a little digging, these two have been cooperating with their missile and nuclear technology. And, you know, you get one solved, then you're going to have to do something about the other. And that's why I think there's a real good chance they're going to do something really drastic on North Korea just to make Iran wake up a bit. But again, you know, you just don't know with the guys in the White House, including the generals and whatever. I mean, these guys, these generals are Democrats for the most part. Now, people forget that when you get a new administration in for two terms, they wean out a lot of the warriors. They kind of put like-minded people in here. I mean, you've seen it with some of the stories leaking out, with people being dismissed because they want to be hawks on Iran where the generals don't. Those are the carryovers and the people from the Obama administration. And you even got the people from the Bush administration that might be carryovers here with their view, the neocons and whatever. So, but again, nobody has a good idea what this guy Trump, what he stands for, what he's going to do until he starts getting something taken care of.
So the dollar's giving you some clues. What would you say about the stock market? Does a big move in the metals require a sentiment shift in the equity space?
No, because people forget at the later stages of bull markets, gold and stocks go together. That's when there's too much liquidity. You saw it in 1980. You see it a lot of times in different markets. The people are like, stocks are too expensive. I'm taking my liquidity and going elsewhere, which is also a factor. I'm sure I've mentioned this in previous interviews here, but the big money over time is made between shifting between real assets and hard assets. The big private money does this because they're slow and they're methodical. But that's, you know, in the 70s, the richest people in the world were all real estate, land, oil and gas, hard asset guys. That's why Buffett didn't have much cachet back then. And then, you know, the last 20 or so years, it's all the paper guys. You know, these social media companies that are, you know, they could disappear tomorrow and there wouldn't be much consequence. And, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars in here. I mean, Apple's effectively a consumer electronics company. It's not a tech company. It's a consumer electronics. Sony. But Sony was in the 80s when they came out with the Discman and digital, all this stuff is what Apple is now. You know, Facebook's a bulletin board or Yellow Pages or whatever. And, you know, you just see this stuff at some point, you know, and that's one reason why the stock market is going up. because virtually everything is overvalued. But at some point, the big private money says, you know, I can't take these asset prices in paper just too much. I've got to get something real in here. And then you saw yesterday, you had the head of Deutsche Bank and also Lloyd Brinkfein, the head of Goldman, talking about bubbles and that they're scared about the stocks being too high. So if stocks get crushed, gold tends to go down just on a short-term basis just because you have liquidity concerns. And everything kind of contracts, the dollar goes up, you know, you get that. But over a longer period of time here, what you have to start looking at, what is the end game? What's the end game for China? We have our debt problems here. We're at $20 trillion in debt. We got a Fed, you know, this $4.5 trillion balance sheet that there's no way they can really unwind it without causing dislocations. So what's the game here? There's no way we can pay down this debt. But then you look at China. China accumulated $24 trillion in debt since the financial crisis, in addition to what they had. They have no way to pay that off. So that's why you hear these central bankers, everyone, inflation's too low, inflation's too low. Well, the average guy or woman sitting at home is getting killed on their healthcare premiums and the housing prices, and they're looking going, wait a minute, you're telling me inflation's good? It's not good for me, especially when my wages are stagnant. No, that's the problem. These central bankers are finally out and open. The reason they're concerned about is inflation is the debt. They can't paper over it. That's why they exist. That's what they've been doing for 10 years now. Is massive negative rates, you know, the QE, they're trying to paper over the unaffordable debt. So what's going to be the end game? And I think the end game here is, you know, whatever happens next, they'll react. If we get very high inflation, you know, they're going to be so far behind the curve, it's going to take them a long time to catch up. And if we get another crisis and we start getting some kind of deflation, what are they going to do? I mean, you've already got negative rates. You know, some of these banks, Japan owns most of their own government debt. You know, if you go on and on and on, you just say, what can these people do? So that's why I think you've really got to start looking more and more to some kind of hedge against central banks and the banking system. Now, banks are getting clubbed today. They're getting hammered hard today. And they've been, all of a sudden, you know, the banks have been really falling over. Now, they rallied when people were thinking, oh, we know higher rates are good for banks, which is funny because I used to trade the bank stocks in the 80s. And every time they cut rates, banks ran, you know, got very strong. So I guess raise rates, good for the banks, cut rates, good for the banks, right? But something else is going on in the banks. And there's a couple of stories out today about how the credit derivatives volume has expanded about 110% over the last week. So somebody's out there trying to hedge defaults on corporate. And I don't know if this is because of the hurricanes. I don't know if this is heavy in insurance companies or banks or whatever. But also you're having problems in the collateral market. You know, in the 10-year note here, the repo rates are exploding here. People are failing to deliver. And what's significant about that, I mean, you see that shows up from time to time. But the reason we were able to call that 2008 crisis ahead of time is we saw in December of 2007 that there were fails all over the world in stocks and bonds. In other words, people that were making transactions, people were not delivering the securities because there was not enough collateral, that there was too much leverage, too much loose lending. People weren't paying attention. I mean, in retrospect, that's what Goldman did in February of 2007, asked AIG to put up more collateral. And that's what was going on. Is this thing was coming apart, people were looking for collateral and it wasn't there, and then it all hit the fan. So there's stuff going on underneath the surface here that is not good. The stock market is really kind of the magician's diversion that keeps you from looking at what he's really doing. And I think that's the problem is, you know, what's going on in the stock is blinding people to what is going on elsewhere. But finally, over the last, you know, few weeks, month or whatever, you can see it. All of a sudden, again, the gold has got that persistent buying in there. And no one's running it away. To me, that's how real and serious buyers buy. They don't want to run it up. Hedge funds and traders do. They want to run it up and sell it before they go home or sell it in 2 or 3 days. The people, to me, that are in the market now, the action appears to be accumulation as opposed to trading.
So, I mean, that's a big shift. You're talking about paper to tangible assets, and you've described that as the big game. This is over long periods of time. And where do you think we're at in terms of a time cycle? You had Richard Rainwater, you know, directing the Bass Brothers to do something like this. Are we talking about something that takes months to play out or something that takes years to play out? Do I lack the imagination to think that it might even be decades?
Well, the thing we don't know is because we're in such unprecedented, you know, they always talk about, never say it's different this time. Well, it is different this time because what we have here is the central bank intervention. Not only is it a record amount, but it's for a record length of time. But you saw this stuff in, well, after World War II where Truman made the Fed monetize debt. But, you know, it didn't last a decade. It lasted for a while. But, you know, then you try to normalize. You know, we're going on a decade of this stuff. You're doing trickle down from the wealthiest 0.1%, hoping that they're keeping the game going here. But we don't know how fast this can unwind because there's so many bubbles, so many places. Where's your refuge? And again, is the problem is, you know, you talk about stock bubbles, but people are missing the point that the biggest bubble possibly of all time is going on with the bonds. Now, you've got countries in Europe that really can't pay their debt. I mean, you can make the case that China and the U.S. and Japan can't pay their debt. But you got low and even negative yields because of the central bank. You can't even call it a manipulation or a rig. They've cornered the market. I mean, that's one of the reasons why you're having these repo problems in the bond market. There's not enough collateral in there because the central banks have bought it. And you're doing the same thing in the stocks. The Swiss National Bank keeps buying U.S. stocks with like $85 billion. But if you look at what they're buying, they're buying the mega cap techs, and the reason they're doing that is Apple, Google, Microsoft are effectively convertible bonds because they have so much cash. If you start going to hell, all that cash makes the stock look like a bond. And of course, if it goes up, you have the upside. So that's one of the things where you see this action in, you know, the FANGs, you know, the big cap tech stocks, where they have so much cash and so little debt. That, you know, people call them their bond substitutes. Well, that's not quite correct. It's really a convertible bond substitute because you still have the upside if the equities go. But with all that cash, if you start falling apart, it puts a floor under it, much like a bond would. But again, this is in the central banks. It's the dislocations and distortions are so great. There's no way you can model this because nobody's ever seen this before. And what happens? Don't know. Don't know how quick this can go. In August of 07, the financial market grind to a halt. That's when T-bills went to 0.14%. Very few people paid attention. That's why it was a joke when people said, oh, we never saw this coming. Nobody saw it coming. That's garbage. A lot of people saw it coming. Bear Stearns goes down in March, and then the market ran. It ran all the way until May. In fact, not until May of 08 when the emerging markets started collapsing. A lot had to do in the debt market first, that people start paying attention. Then finally, Lehman went down in September, and then how fast did it go, right? October, November, December, people thought that was it. We're in a Great Depression. But they ignored it forever. And that's the problem with what the central banks have done. People now, just like North Korea, you're talking a nuclear war, and people, what do you get? A 1% decline? Please. I mean, please. Because nobody thinks it's going to happen. Or they think you buy every dip. So to get back to your question is, when can this happen? How fast can it go? I don't know. It's, again, you're talking about the emperor has no clothes type of market. When people, when they lose faith, there's no telling what's going to happen and how quick it can go here. Because once you make people see the reality, you make them see the garb, you make them see the debt, you make them see the overvaluations, you make them see what the central banks have done and the amount of debt on and on and on, the geopolitical situation, yeah, there's no telling what can happen and how fast. That's why I think you've got to increase your exposure in here to gold, silver, and some of these hard hedges.
You go back to 2000, 2001, and you had an ethical erosion, which had been taking place for a while. But, you know, as Buffett likes to say, you get to see who's swimming naked when the tide goes out. And today it's Wells Fargo with fake accounts or Facebook and Google misrepresenting their traffic to boost what they charge for ads. And it doesn't really show up in the share price necessarily. But these are the kinds of things that actually play a role in a radical shift in investor sentiment. What you're talking about, kind of an aha moment where all of a sudden the aggregation of things, maybe it's a few ethical breaches, maybe it's looking at the debt. Who knows what the straw is that breaks the camel's back, but you've already got enough there in terms of straw to do that.
Absolutely.
So 1050 was the low in gold in 2015. Here we are, you know, $300 higher, now 1300 plus. If you're looking at sort of downside risk versus upside potential, you're saying, look, the dollar's telling you what you need to know. From a trader's view, what is that? Upside potential versus downside risk?
I have no idea. You can't project. The thing is, if you want to say what's the upside in gold, you can't pick a number. It's like picking a number in Bitcoin. And the reason Bitcoin is going berserk, that's where the wise guys, that's where the public is, that's where the guys that listen to CNBC and follow that goofy stuff that gets said on there. And the other thing is, I remember Propellerhead, he had me in 2010 trying to convince me to buy Bitcoin. Of course, I'm kicking myself that I put a few thousand dollars in, it'd be worth hundreds of millions now. But the thing I missed, not what it was, you know, he made me understand it, where I failed to miss was that we have this society of people now that will buy crap. Because Apple put it out, or they're in love with Facebook or Google or whatever, because it becomes a cult. They have a cult following. And this stuff is like, oh, this is this complicated algorithm. It can't be hacked. It can't, you know, when it all falls apart, who do I go to get my money? The computer? I mean, again, what's behind this thing? Well, it's this great algorithm. But it appealed to the same thing you saw in 2000, 1998, 99, and 2000, this mentality of, no, I don't really understand it, but it's high tech and it's great, which we had in the 60s. People forgot the 68, the big Onyx boom. Anything would add Onyx on it. People were buying like crazy because that was it. This was the coming computer age, the space age, and they got their brains beat out. But that's the thing that is going on that is helping drive the Bitcoin in those cyber currencies is people in Europe and China and Russia in particular that want their money outside the banking system. There's a couple of reasons. One, they don't trust it. They don't want to go through 2008, 2009. The other is the political. You know, the U.S., and people before would put their money in Switzerland and not worry about it, but then the U.S. twisted Swiss arms enough that now, you know, they got rid of their secrecy. And so you say to yourself, where do you want assets? And that's why a lot of the big private smart money, most of the billionaires I know or talk to all have some kind of gold and physical. They want an asset outside of the control of the banking system, because we all know the banking system and the governments are joined at the hip. They both go down together, especially since 2008. The governments all bailed out the big banks. So now the big banks, the central banks, and the governments are all joined at the hip. They go up together, they go down together. And that's why I think you're seeing some of that fascination is it's really a lot of Far East money going in there and Russian money. And then, of course, it creates a mania of its own. But, you know, that's another clue that something is not quite correct here.
We look at the markets, and as you mentioned earlier, whether it's Blankfein at Goldman or the CEO at Deutsche Bank, beginning to get concerned, looking at strange things in relation to corporate yields versus stock yields. What do they get out of those kinds of comments? Is this sort of a, hey, look, don't hold us accountable. We told you there was something wrong. Or are they positioning ahead of something? What do their statements actually mean?
You know what you don't know? Because you have to know the analyst. When I worked on Wall Street, especially in the groups that I was trading, I always sat down with the analysts regularly, you know, at least once a month, sometimes once a week, and to find out what they really know, what they're really thinking, because they can't always tell you what they're really thinking. There's other pressures within. I remember one time, big name brokerage firm, I was trying to tech group, and I have a meeting with the guy. He was a well-known analyst, good guy, and I'm asking him about IBM, and he's going, this thing is a piece of you-know-what. So, you know, trying to change the company. This is in the 80s when the mainframes were falling out of favor for the PCs. And he said, yeah, but it's like turning a super tanker in the East River. You know, it's not going to be good for a while. 2 days later in the morning meeting, they go, here, you know, is blah, blah with his kind of call on IBM. I go, this is going to be good. Gets on. I love IBM. I make it a 1-1, which means, you know, 1-1 was a short-term buy and also long-term strong. And I'm like, okay, and I'm counting myself, figuring how long it's going to be before he leaves the communication room back to his office, and I'm calling him going, Jay, what the hell did you just do? He goes, hey, I don't like it, but they made me push it. And plus, the economic committee thinks the GDP is going up, and if they think that, then the investment committee thinks you got to buy IBM because they'll have all this capital spending. It's going to help them. So that's why you never know. You don't know what the real deal is. The other thing is you don't know the analysts that have something to say, and others are just are talking because they're justifying their paychecks. And the other thing is, you know, a lot of times they're out there just trying to create commissions. That started happening in the 80s. We saw these calls going out more regularly with really minuscule changes in them because they wanted to start driving activity. And of course, by the 90s, when you had a lot of hedge funds, you know, you get up there and you change your earnings by a penny, you cause a big rally. In fact, what we started getting, which was ludicrous, was a guy come out, I reiterate my buy rating on Apple. Oh, stock's up 5 points today because, you know, Manny Moe and Jack reiterated their buy. Well, I remember years ago when I started a business, if you called somebody up, an institutional account, said, oh, we reiterated our buy on GM, they would kill you. Don't waste my time with that crap. Tell me when you change something. But we came a different era where the traders and the algos start dominating the market. So that's one of the reasons they go out there, because they'll be on the tape. Oh, XYZ was up today because Joe Blow reiterated his buy or changed the rating or changed the number. So, and there's a lot of garbage on it. That's why, you know, the CNBC and people ridicule them a lot because, you know, they're putting these people on. They have to fill airtime, and they put people on there, and they say whatever they say to get the airtime or to get their name out there or to get people to follow them on Twitter or whatever.
I want to come back to gold in a minute, but the two things that seem to be sort of horns on the bull, if you will, would be political dysfunction in the United States and geopolitical craziness. I mean, if we think of DC as a chessboard, where do you think the greatest pressure is and who's got the advantage at present?
Well, there's pressure everywhere. The problem is, again, it wasn't just Obama, but the other administrations, But they just did not do anything. They put a shroud over the chessboard so you don't know where the pieces were. And now what's happening is we're pulling the shroud off of the chessboard and we're going, oh my God, this is a terrible position here. And there's, like I said, with North Korea, there's no good choices. There's no good choices with Iran also. But the longer you don't do anything, the worse it's going to get. So that's the problem here. There's a lot of these things. And of course, the media ignored it because they didn't want to bring it up. You know, on Obama's watch, that you got this other situation going on. And of course, you know, what Bush did in the Mideast is not good. And you just created all these horrible situations here that have been getting worse and worse, right? You go in there and you topple Saddam. Then what's happened since then? You know, how about Gaddafi? You knocked him out. You know, you wanted him gone for 30 years. You finally got it. How's that work? You know, you keep going through this list. And that's why you get this horrible immigration situation in Europe, is because they just, you know, so much of Northern Africa. Of course, it started when the Serbian War, Herzegovina and Serbia War, when that blew up in the 90s. And I mean, you're just, the order around the world is just going to heck. And, you know, part of it was Bush did too much, Obama did too little. And now you got a problem. And I don't know how you're going to clean it up. Don't know. Because nobody's done anything yet. There's just a lot of talk. But we don't know what's going on behind the scenes. We don't know if money's going into covert ops. We don't know if money's going into Swiss bank accounts. You don't know. You don't know. You got to wait and see how this stuff starts playing out. You just don't know.
You remember the summer of 68. I mean, we've got paid protesters here in the U.S. right now.
Yep.
And I just wonder if this chapter in social and political history can be resolved peacefully. Is there a difference between what was happening in 68? Because, I mean, this time around seems to be privately funded.
Well, yeah, in 68, the communists, you know, Russia, Soviet Union was funding a lot of the protest. You know, you got a number of people in here. You could Google and see all the different people involved in this stuff. But the thing that, and this is why we thought Trump would win and also why the Republicans would take control in 2014, is because you had Ferguson, Baltimore. When you have social chaos and violence, Republicans win. And the latter is because the women that normally vote Democrat get concerned about personal safety. You know, the men have not voted for Democrats since LBJ, president. But usually the suburban women are just real swing voters. Now, the thing that helped Trump was blue-collar workers became swung to Trump more. The big surprise was how well he did with women. If you look at the Democratic breakdown, considering the ridiculous stuff he says and has said, you know, women, there's more women in the workforce than men now. More women bring home paychecks. And, you know, they're more sensitive to economic issues, but it's the personal safety. Decades ago, I learned from Al Sinlinger, the number one issue is always pocketbook. The number two issue is personal safety, and it's broken into national security and domestic security. And when you start rioting and you have the demonstrations and, you know, we got one in Chicago today with a block in Lakeshore Drive for, I don't know, it would be a variety of reasons to protest, probably about DACA. But whatever, you know, people get upset about it, and they don't want to hear that. They don't want to see that. And the more you have these protests, the more you see Trump is going up in the ratings again. And even after Charlottesville, people couldn't believe he went up in there. And it was really ridiculous what he said, but people saw the violence. And they also understood that the Antifa people, you know, what they were doing, they've been doing it elsewhere, and they've been doing it for a couple of years now. And then all of a sudden, the people want some kind of order put back in here. And I think they're playing right into Trump's hand. If you didn't know better, you'd think Trump was funding this stuff because it helps him. And people come out and say the stupidest stuff and do the stuff. You know, you look at the polls, people overwhelmingly want free speech. They don't want the universities. They don't want the people running around in masks stopping people from speaking, no matter what they have to say, which is kind of what the Constitution is about. Is the reason you have that is for speech that you don't want to hear or you think is disgusting and whatever. But you're right. It plays into the scenario you had in the late 60s where Nixon, who was another guy, was incredibly unlikable. You know, the same people, he looked furtive. He looked, you know, that whole routine. But, you know, he won in 68. He won 49 states in 72, even while he was under the shadow of the burgeoning Watergate thing, because people wanted order. They wanted personal safety. And they wanted a strong leader in there. I don't want to say Trump's a Nixonian, but the people who voted Nixon in expected him to do order, but also get the economic house in order, which was starting to fall apart in the late 60s, especially after the, you know, LBJ's Great Society. But what Nixon did was he actually expanded LBJ's programs. And that's when you saw, when you had the inflation shock of in 73 and 4, and then you saw, you know, Nixon closed the gold window in August of 71. Because the foreigners figured out what he was doing. That, wait a minute. And that's what I'm thinking here is where, and I'm glad you brought it up because it's analogous to Trump, where everybody says, oh, this guy is going to be, he's never been a conservative. He's not a conservative, but people read that into, he's going to do balance to buy, he's going to do all this stuff, and it's not. Now they're starting to look and go, hey, wait a minute, maybe this guy's going to do a Nixon on foreign policy. And we know what that means. It means the dollar goes to the hell in a handbasket and precious metals and hard assets go up. So I think it was good that you brought up that analogy of what was going on in the late 60s and what's going on here. You can see it in the political. Now, does this get resolved? You know, it doesn't get resolved until you get a good economy. That's really what Reagan did, is once you get the economy booming again. I think Trump knows that. I don't think he's going to have the same success because it's a different environment. You've got 95 million people unemployed or not in the workforce. Some of it's because they can't find jobs. Some of it's because they're disabled. But most of it's because they get a check for doing nothing. And it's going to be hard to disabuse those people of that notion. And plus, the other thing is you do have all this automation. Anytime wages start going up, especially on blue collar, people just automate. And it's not just the wage. It's the benefits, and it's the legality. It's the regulations, the pension benefits, the health care. You know, $15 an hour, whatever it is, yeah, that's one factor. But when you start lobbying on all the other things that businesses have to pay, and there are costs in regulation, if you talk to anybody in manufacturing or production, there's a lot of costs involved in that. So everybody's automating as much as possible.
So kind of sitting the fence between domestic political issues and international complications, you've got Trump who's hoping to bring in tariffs. He keeps on saying, I want tariffs. What does he hope to accomplish, and what is he likely to accomplish if he gets what he wants with tariffs?
Well, he's trying to keep his coalition together, which, again, is the blue-collar workers. You know, the guys left behind. And it's also flyover America. The East Coast elites are so out of touch. I mean, you see how many times, you know, with Trump, when, oh, he just said something bad about John McCain. He's finished. No, it actually helped him. Oh, he just went after Megyn Kelly. You know, who cares about Megyn Kelly? Because she had good ratings because she followed Bill O'Reilly. I mean, look at how she's done at NBC. It's a disaster. But the media, see, the media doesn't say with any kind of real analysis for the most part. Most of those guys just want affirmation of their biases. So Trump says something mean to Megyn Kelly. Oh, that's it. He's blew himself up. No, he went up in the polls. You could just go through the whole list. The same thing with the Charlottesville. That's it. He's done. He's going to be impeached. No, he actually went up in the polls on that. And now, you know, again, he's moving up again on this.
He's playing to a domestic audience on the tariff issue.
And of course, the Europeans don't like what he's doing because he's trying to make them address their problems. That's what Trump promised. As opposed to Hillary, he went out, and this is classic. It's classic. It's in all the research. If you want to be a successful candidate, go out and articulate what the problems are. Then come up with reasonable proposals. Finally, what's interesting is even if you don't enact the reasonable proposals and solve the problems, if you try, you get reelected. It's clear. It's exactly clear how to win a campaign. And that's what Trump did. He said, here's your problems. Whether it was the immigration, whether it was the foreign trade, whatever. And now he's trying to pull solutions. And we'll find out, you know, a year from now, 2018, when the campaigns start. But right now, all those candidates that have been opposing Trump are in trouble in the initial polls here, which, you know, doesn't make sense if you read all the Gallup and all these other polls. You know, the polls that had Trump losing by 12 and 14 points now say he's, you know, so unpopular. But, and also the record amount of money coming into the Republican Party, and it's coming from small contributors, not coming from big corporations. But at some point, he has to do something. And that's, in a Machiavellian world, you might think that the Republicans are delaying and then put the first 100 days through that he wanted because they want to do it closer to the 2018 election. And I can understand that. That would make political sense. From Trump's standpoint, he'd like to have it start happening, you know, in 2019. And in the 20, when it starts happening for his reelection opportunities there, if he wants to get reelected, there's a lot, and a lot of people I talk to, or a number of people I talk to, not a lot of people, a number who know Trump personally, even before he got elected, thought one term, this guy is not going to want to do this job. You know, this doesn't fit his temperament, his mentality. So, you know, in his age, whatever, you don't know. You just don't know beyond that. But, you know, so I wonder if the Republicans have been doing this slow play so they could get it done at 18. And they have really no issues for the Democrats to run on. But we'll see.
Your gut on North Korea, it's tied at the hip to the Iranian issue. What does it mean for our relationship with China? And what's your gut on North Korea?
Well, here's what he's doing. You can see, you know, you don't need any deep insight that he's trying to pressure China into reigning in North Korea. And he's saying, you know what? We'll do what we have. We put tariffs on. We got a trade issue here with you guys. And he's campaigned against that. And he's going to have to try to do something about that. It just depends on the severity of what you can do here. The other thing here, you know, China's got this enormous debt problem. And if you're really, you know, the neocon thinking where you're, the immediate battle is with radical Islam in North Korea, but the big strategic battle is with China for for control of the next century. That's another reason why this North Korea thing, if at some point you go in there and just obliterate North Korea or Kim or whatever, I'm sending a message to China and Iran and Russia and everybody else here. And that's the reason, you know, when you didn't do anything, you know, Bill Clinton in 94 cut this deal with North Korea and said, oh, they'll be totally out of the nuclear business by 95. Yeah, how'd that work out? Every other year, they'd rattle a saber, and the U.S. would send them more money just to shut them up. And what did they do with the money? They didn't really improve the living standards for their people. They went on and bought more technology, weapons technology, nuclear technology, and now we're at. So something's going to have to be done, because now that they're in the hydrogen era there, hydrogen bomb era, and now they've got ICBMs, you got a problem. And it's only going to get worse if you don't do something about it. And then you have to start wondering, politically, when do you do it? That become the other thing. Or how long can you go? Now, what we don't know behind the scenes is what is going on. You know, there might be some going with China, and they can't come out and just say what's really going on, nor can Putin, nor can other people. But again, it's like Schumer taking all these shots at Trump, and they're good buddies. And they saw the picture yesterday. They're kind of laughing and hugging in the White House when they do this deal. So, you know, you have your public consumption, and you have the private, what's really going on. And the other thing is, there are some serious domestic terror threats that are going on right now in this country and that they're trying to be careful with. You know, coming from south of the border, you know, you saw that a couple weeks ago, stories reported they found some tunnel and people popped out of this. And the reason they found this tunnel they didn't know existed, because people popped out of it in some town in Texas and they didn't know they were there. And they happened to be Chinese. Now, what the hell is that? And the cover story is, oh, these were just a lot of dishwashers and cooks. Really? Where'd they get that kind of money to come through that tunnel? And who controls that tunnel and what's really going on? So there's some concerns about that. That's why a lot of people think Kelly's in the White House as chief of staff. It's not, you could say, about putting order in there, but he's thrown out all Trump's buddies and people. But the stories we're hearing from people that have been very right in the past about the FBI and Comey and what was really going on with him is that they're concerned about what's been coming through that tunnel and what might be in here. So, you know, that's the other side.
Well, we've heard a little less in the news cycle recently on Russia, except maybe for Poland. And is the media just aware that they're kind of beating a dead horse on that?
Yeah, they are. And beyond that is it's bit them on the butt. It's come back and bit them, because now you're looking at all these things that the Clinton Foundation did. You might have Manford, you know, you might have him on whatever, you know, leaking out. They might have him on some different money issues and financial transactions. But in the process, you uncovered some of Hillary's people were with him doing these deals. And now you bring in the Podesta brothers, and you go, whoa, wait a minute. And that's why you're absolutely dead correct in your observation. This thing's blowing up on them. Now you got the Comey thing. They thought they had the Comey. Now it comes out Comey lied. And I tried to think, should I say it politely? No, he did. He lied to Congress, lied to American people, and they've got him. I don't know if I mentioned this with you, but we did it in our conference calls, is that our sources told us that Comey, July 5th, that most of the people wanted Hillary indicted. He got up and said, no, nobody wanted this. And that's why he made these guys sign non-disclosure agreements, because they wanted charges brought or further investigation. He didn't do the grand jury. And he now it comes out that he had the decision made April or May by his own chief of staff saying that. And that was well before the investigation was going on. And they scuttled it. They destroyed evidence. They gave immunity deals. And he's up there saying, no, nobody wanted to do this. And we heard all along, it was his right-hand man, McCabe, who took the money from McAuliffe, who, you know, besides being governor of Virginia, was also a longtime money guy for the Clintons. And now you got the deputy counsel, who's the other guy in decision. They've got him for leaking the surveillance thing they were doing with Yahoo to Reuters. And McCabe's got like three different investigations going about him, one of which is sexual harassment. And it's just an absolute mess that was going on at the FBI. If they would have just let this thing alone, nobody would have known this. But now you want to put prosecutor, you put investigators. But then the other thing is you put people inside the FBI that are livid, that really like the FBI, that they've destroyed it and politicized it. You know, you got the Lynch situation now, and you got Obama's situation. You know, it all starts coming back to them. And that's why you're not hearing as much on Russia, is because the Democrats now wish it would just all go away, because there was nothing there. But the real problem, you want obstruction? You got obstruction. It's called Comey, Lynch, and Obama, what they did with the Clintons. And now you got that going. So you're right. So that's funny, because you went from Russia, you went to Charlottesville. Now that the Antifa kept beating up people at Berkeley or whatever, now you don't hear that anymore. So now, you know, it's definitely Manford. And you had Donald Jr. testifying at the Intelligence Committee, I think the Senate maybe. But you're right, that's all kind of wound down here, because it's kind of blowing up on them.
So you've got folks that are, you know, in senior positions at the Fed who are expected to take on even greater leadership roles. I think of Stanley Fisher stepping down as vice chair. Is that to avoid a reputational hit in anticipation, perhaps, of financial market chaos?
That's what I'm putting out here is, you know, he doesn't want to be riding in the Fed's clown car when this all blows up. I mean, again, when you got Goldman and Hedrick Blankfein, just saying, I mean, this is a guy that feasts at the trough at the Fed and saves him. Same thing with Deutsche Bank, who, you know, with their derivative book and all this other, and they're saying, guys, we have a problem. We have a real problem here, Fed. Stop it. Do something. Well, you know, you can see this with whether it's Draghi or Yellen or whatever. They keep saying, oh, we're going to do it and get the market all set. We're going to normalize. And then they get one piece of bad economic data or something, and they speak, and then they turn dovish, like Yellen, with the double reverse, right? It was ridiculous. Same thing with Draghi. And they kept expecting him to say something. Nope, won't say it because they're scared to death that they're going to knock stocks down. Why should that matter? Unless there's something really bad out there.
Yeah, because, I mean, Brainard says, you know, caution's warranted on further rate tightening. We've got 4.4 on the unemployment number. We've got 3% GDP growth. Right. Why is the Fed cautious? What do they see that keeps them cautious?
Because those numbers are all garbage. Think of this garbage, the debt. You can't pay the debt. That's the problem. There's too much debt. I mean, the reason we had the 2008 crisis was too much debt, not enough collateral, not enough income. And the solution was, let's put more debt on. It's okay. You're a business, and all of a sudden, you have a liquidity problem, you take on debt. That's fine. But if you have a solvency problem, and that's the difference. You have a liquidity problem where you're just short of cash, that's what the Fed's for. Here, you guys, go right ahead, get going again. You know, it's like a business. If you got a problem, you go to your bank, you go, I can buy this new plant equipment, I'll be twice as efficient, cut my payroll in half, and, you know, we're going to make a lot of money. Okay, yeah, here's the money, go do it. But if it's like, you know, I just need the money because we're just so screwed, it's not funny. And we're just going to hope a genie appears and we're going to get 4% GDP for the next 5 years so I can pay off this loan. That's what you're doing here. I mean, it's the debt. It all comes down to debt. Mathematics, you look at it, just doesn't work. That's why they don't want to talk about it, because it's immutable. That number's immutable. You know, you could talk sizzle. You could talk about, CBO can project, Obamacare does this, and infrastructure. And the CBO has never been right about anything. I don't want anybody even pays attention. That's ridiculous. That, well, a CBO says, who cares? They're horribly wrong. And everything they've touched, it's just a political mechanism. But that's the problem, is the math tells you, the debt tells you. When you start seeing it, we have to figure out the GDP growth. You look at the demographics. You look at the technology, where the jobs can come from. And you also have to look at the baby boom, all these countries aging. And you're at the point now where the boomers are really going to start retiring in mass here every year in the U.S. And it's just going to start really driving up the health care and the Social Security cost. And they know that. They're not that stupid. But they're just, you know, the problem is they got caught. The whole reason you had the Fed was to be a lender of last resort. But over the years, they took on more and more importance because they were helping the government. And then these egos got out of control. I mean, when I started this business, even in the 80s, you know, you might know Volcker, but who knew who the vice chairman was? Who knew who the presidents were? Now these guys are on the tape almost every day talking and this, and they think they're rock stars. Go away. We don't need to hear you guys. Do your policy. If you want to tell us something, pretty much do it. But you got all these guys out running their mouths now. The media has got them on all the time, and it's ridiculous. It doesn't serve any purpose, except it's more harmful. But it gives the algos and traders something to trade a few ticks every day with when they're talking. But it's not helpful in the big picture.
So if the big picture, if the real issue here is debt, not enough collateral, in the right circumstance, not enough income, you know, we've got the Fed balance sheet, the ECB balance sheet, the BOJ, who arguably, and they would argue, look, we can step in, we can buy our way to success. And I had a conversation with a guy from the Bank of England, and I said, well, what happens if the Fed boosts their balance sheet to 10 trillion? He said, no problems, we just sterilize. Not a big deal. No inflationary impact. It's not like the old school monetization. And I sat there and scratched my head and I thought, is he shining me? Does he really think that you can buy the sun, moon, and stars with paper or credit that's come from nothing and there's no inflationary effect?
Well, see, the problem is that was the buzzword in the late 80s when they started intervening again. We're sterilizing our intervention. But, you know, it was a disinflationary time. That's the problem, is we're in a period of enormous disinflation. The first shock, Reagan created the disinflation, the oil in the 80s there to take down the evil empire. And it worked. The next inflationary shock we got was the stock market collapse in 87. Then we had Japan bursting their bubble in 1990. And then you do the series, you had a whole, you know, Mexico 94. And then you got into Japan panicked in April of 95, went to zero rates because the deflation was running away. Then you had, you know, long-term capital go down. You had Russia go down 98. You know, we had the great stock bubble here because they were pumping money like crazy. And of course, in the 90s, you know, the Soviet Union collapsed. China was in collapse. The communist world was in collapse. That's enormously deflationary. So in the 90s, Japan was bursting their bubble, and the communist world was deflating. And you had this nascent technology industry that was developing in the 80s, was burgeoning in the 90s. The technologies were coming to the market, were being implemented. So again, there's less need for workers. And of course, then you had the bubble burst here, and these guys, they knew this. Greenspan, that's when he went and got Bernanke. He was the depression specialist, brought him in 2002, because they thought, you know, after 9/11 and the tech bubble burst, they thought, here we go. And then they ran the property bubble, the housing bubble, to try to keep the depression away. Of course, then, you know, all that led to was the 2008-09 crisis. And that's what you're going through. And what they do is they don't understand, but when you make money this cheap, you give business incentive to fire people and to buy machines. And that's people, I know that from my neighbors, are small businessmen. All they keep doing is buying more machines. And it's amazing. Over the last 10, 15 years, I know a guy has a blister board packaging. He's a great indicator for the economy because he has everything from auto parts and locks to magic markers. And over a 15-year period, he's cut his payroll more than half. He's probably down 60 to 70%, and his output's up threefold because the technology is so much better in printing. And I'm talking these massive print machines they buy from Germany. It's just astounding how much more output he has and how few but he's done with his payroll. It's just amazing. And that's going on all over. And that's the dilemma you have. You have nowhere to really get with the growth in industry. You know, since the crisis of 08, it was in restaurants and hospitality, healthcare, whatever. These low-paying gigs. I mean, you got college students, and I know a lot of my children's friends and classmates, whatever, that they're tending bar, they're waiting tables, and they actually make more money than working in some of the media industries. It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. And, you know, how long can you do that? And now you're seeing the restaurant has rolled over in the last year. You're seeing this, I don't know what they call them, but, you know, it's the restaurants that are just above the McDonald's, but aren't the high scale, are starting to have trouble. Because people are either going to McDonald's or going, you know, more of a Carrabba's or Papado's or one of those type of places. But it's the guys in between, you know, the kind of the just step above the fast food are starting to struggle. And again, you look out and you go, how do we solve our problem? Give me the end game. What industry is going to pop up here is going to start really creating jobs for everybody? The only one I could always think of was the biotech on that. But that's kind of, you're getting a drug. But again, the technology is, you don't need that many workers. You need researchers, but you need ideas more than you need able bodies in that. And of course, the other thing you're doing is once you've unleashed all the refugees from Northern Africa and even from the Arab world, how many of these people are skilled workers? When you look at their economies, what's in their economy? So you know they don't have experience. What are they doing here? And you're bringing these people in and they thought, well, you know, they're here because they'll do jobs. What jobs? What are they qualified for? What's their training? So that's why if you sit down, you try to think the end game. How are we going to get out from all this debt? Are we going to produce our way out? Are we going to get a jobs boom? And I think you're seeing the economy do better with because Trump got rid of rules and regulation. You're seeing a little more. But you don't see the kind of boom you had post-World War II. At the end of World War II, everybody thought we were going into depression. I remember, you know, my parents telling me all the time that you're in this 30s depression, and sure, you had the war technology. You know, the war problem came out. You got some new technology, automation. They thought, oh, all these GIs are coming home. You know, the women are going to go back to the households. Where are we going to, how are we going to employ all these guys? You know, it took a couple, 3 years, but then you had this enormous boom, and what people missed was, during World War II, most everybody worked, and then you couldn't buy anything. You know, everything was rationed. So people had savings. You had incredible pent-up savings. You had incredible pent-up demand, and you didn't have much debt, except the government. Now, there's no pent-up savings. There's no pent-up demand. People are buying, you know, you don't have that kind of kick. And then the same thing, you had the Reagan revolution. Now, he cut taxes, but also you took interest rates. For crying out loud, the long bond went from, what, 16 down to, you know, a single number. You know, T-bills went from 22 down to, what, 6? I mean, that's an incredible boost. I mean, that's an enormous boost to the economy when you get rates cut that big. Plus, all again, you had a nascent tech industry appearing. You know, all that tech innovation was going on. Where's it coming from? Where's our next boom going to come from? I don't know.
So again, back to the idea of the big game, where someone who's not managing money for the next quarter or day trading, but is managing money on an intergenerational basis and is concerned about the years, but more concerned about the decades, the shift towards tangible assets, you think that's underway?
Yeah, because the game, and I've mentioned this with you, and we've been talking about this for 20 years, the key was when the communist world went bankrupt. These countries are bankrupt. The socialism is big government in all its forms, fascism, socialism, communism, it's bankrupt. They can't afford it anymore. That's what the whole crisis of 2008 was about. And that's where the governments came in and had to bail out all the big banks because they're the ones who were financing it. Now, what they did with that is they made the situation worse. Now, the big banks can't go down because they'll take the central banks down and they'll take down the governments. And it's because you can't afford the socialism anymore, the freebies, whatever your form. Remember, the economy, again, fascist, whatever you want to call it. the debt is so large, you can't afford it anymore. And that's what's coming down. And what's interesting, if you look at that's why the politics are so divisive right now, because people, whether they inherently understand it or it's just a feeling, is if you see government has never been bigger, it's never provided more freebies, but the people that are getting them have never been more upset than they are now. They want more, which is the human nature. You know, whatever you have, it's not enough because these hedge fund guys are living in $100 million houses. So what if I can get free cable, free Air Jordans, whatever? You know, look at these guys. And then the people that are getting taxed, and of course the people getting squeezed the most are middle class. That's why Trump's sitting in the White House. Because the top end is getting taken care of by the stock bubbles or the bond bubbles or whatever. And the underclass is looking at that and they're mad, and the media is beating on them to be mad. You should be mad. And the government can't deliver. So the last thing was the Obamacare. That's the last freebie. Here, have some. Here, do this one. And all you did is drive my insurance rate is going up 300%. It's ridiculous. Now, you know, I'll be going on Medicare soon, and so fine. But that's what's happening more and more. That's what the government's in here, and they're driving the cost up, and you've socialized it. And that's why you're getting these arguments now are on social issues. If you look and see where the left is coming, it's all social issues now. Because they can't talk the economics because they've been a bust. And it's blowing up. So now you got to get people upset about Civil War statues or transgender issues. Instead of in the past, we were talking about how do you take care of your family? How do you get your kids educated? That's why the coasts are out of touch with flyover America. Because people still want to take care of their kids, take care of their families. They want some personal safety. They want a future. But that's why this is getting so vicious in that, because either you know it because you're doing the work and you're looking at it, or you feel it, is that this is we're in an endgame of something with big government. And now that's why you're getting, you can't have Charles Murray speak, because what he's going to say is divisive. What's divisive? He's given you, you know, the conservative view, but that's divisive now. So you don't let him speak. That also tells you lost the argument. But it goes back to the big government blowing up. You know, they promise you everything, and now you just don't have the money to do it. And so it's going to be interesting to see, you know, again, with what Trump does here, how this thing plays out. But I think all the indicators are there. You better start getting some assets that are out of control of the government and the banking system. Now, I'm not telling you put it all in there. I'm not telling you leverage up to do it. But from a survival standpoint and an insurance standpoint, you got to start thinking ahead. See, that's what the big private money learned in 08. People think you just learned that you were over-leveraged and everything went down and you had market risk and it got too risky. The really wealthy people, the smart people figured out was, because what was going on with the collateral and everybody collapsing, people didn't know their assets were safe. So you had custodian risk. Oh, I'm a multi-billionaire because of my stock holdings. Well, where are they? Well, they're sitting at Goldman Sachs, or they're sitting at J.P. Morgan, or sitting at State Street Bank or whatever. Yeah, go get them. See if they're still there. See what's there. You know, what's the deal here? And that's why that thing got so vicious and why it was really lights out, because you had this custodial risk. People didn't know where the collateral was, how much had it, who had control of it, and who was grabbing for it. That's why I think you're seeing this persistent buying in the gold from the big money. Same thing you see in diamond, you see in all these. You saw that in the art for all those years too, all the big hedge fund guys. Why? Because it's outside control of the financial system and the government.
Right. So you're out of counterparty risk.
All you need is good security. Right? You need a good security system.
That's right.
You know, it got really big. It was doing the gold in vaults overseas and Swiss banks and that. And I'm sure that's still going on. And if you had an enormous amount of money, you have a different problem. You know, what you do with all of it. But I think for the average person, you want to have possession of something that can keep you going for a couple, 3 years. If something really bad happens, keep you and your family going, keep you, you know, from dire straits here.
So in generic terms, if you're allocating assets and you're looking at sort of a 2 to 4 year time horizon, you think moving beyond an insurance position in the metals, kind of worst case, actually beefing up that position makes sense?
Yeah, I think thinking in terms of 5% as an insurance position of your assets or your investable assets or whatever you want to use, like whatever, that's fine. But now I think you should be 10, looking to go higher depending on how things start playing out. But I wouldn't go over 20 yet. So I think you should be 10 to 20 right now, depending again how much money you have. You know, if you got hundreds of billions, you want to have a little more in there. The average guy, you know, it's not. You just, again, wants some insurance. But now I think it's time. You need to increase your insurance because I think the hurricane's approaching. But I also think you're at the point now where you can start getting speculative buying, where you're also doing this to profit. Before, I thought it was just mainly insurance. And again, it's like if you know a hurricane's coming, you want to up your insurance. I think we're at that stage now where you up your insurance and you start taking on some small speculative risks. Again, the thing that could really upset this is if the Fed or some central bank really says, that's it, we're normalizing, and here we go. But again, we don't know how long that lasts. But if you see signs of the central banks caving in and normalizing, then gold's going to go ridiculous. And again, as I couldn't put a number on it, but if you want to see what it can look like, look at Bitcoin. That's what I would say. That would be the analogy. And once it gets going, it's going to be real hard to stop.
Well, we appreciate you bringing in some market perspective and sort of in the trenches experience. There's lots of ways to look at the world. You can look at it, use your library card and read lots and maybe take an academic approach. And there's elements that are helpful there, but there's something that battle hardening does to you. And in this case, it's sort of market related battle hardening. And Bill, I've always appreciated your perspectives and your insights. Look forward to our next conversation and wish you well.
Thank you. You too.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Bill King. You can call us at 800-525-9556, or you can find us online at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.